make in California. The assembly man, I'm one.
Hey, good afternoon. Good afternoon. Opening the
is it really
now opening a meeting of the House Higher Ed Workforce Development Committee on Tuesday, May 30th, 2017. And this is the next to the last policy meeting. And just a brief announcement. We've had a late-breaking breakthrough on Senate Bill 207A. Excellent work that was done last Friday. But we're going to have to carry it over. The fiscal is not yet complete. The bill's great. Fiscal's not ready yet. So we'll get to come back together next Thursday, hopefully about 10 minutes. We'll come in, work the bill, and be out. So that's what's going on there. And then today we do have two informational presentations scheduled. Looking forward to those. And we'll start with presentation on GED testing. Vice Chair Alonzo Leon has helped to organize this for us today, and we appreciate that. We'd also like to extend a special welcome to our testifier, Scott Silvestris, I'll get that right, who has traveled here from the East Coast. So thanks for joining us, Scott. Appreciate that. One other thought. Oh, we will have folks maybe in and out today. I know we have Vice Chair Wisnett is off testifying on a number of bills. Rep. Johnson probably doing the same, and I think a couple of others may have to leave early.
I have a 4 o'clock.
Okay, so don't be offended. It's nothing you've said. Okay. So I'm opening an informational hearing related to GED testing. I can bonk it.
Kind of expect.
And Rep. Alonzo Leon, did you want to go down or stay up here?
I'd like to make my remarks up here. Did you want to have them join the yet?
Or Scott and Donna, if you'd like to come up, that'd be great.
So as they're finding their spot on the on their seats, I'll go ahead and get started. I'm very excited that we have this great opportunity to share how the high school equivalency program has evolved at the state level. Restructuring the state GED program, now called the high school equivalency program, has been one of my favorite opportunities as a professional in making changes, particularly because I earned my GED. Earning a GED for many people is a great accomplishment because it's a pathway to opportunity. I've heard countless stories from GED graduates about how earning their GED changed their lives. However, a negative stigma still exists around people who earned their GED. Our society still values the high school diploma more than the high school equivalency certificate. While I agree that we should push and challenge our young people to earn their high school diploma, for many in our community, earning a high school diploma is not possible. I think it's time to change this negative perception. People should not be judged for earning a GED. Rather, they should be judged for what they do with their GED. In my case, it led me to becoming the first in my family to earn a master's degree and become a legislator. In 2014, when I became the new GED administrator, a perfect storm was brewing. A new test version had just come out. People were discussing the Secretary of State's audit and the Portland City Club's recommendations on the current GED program. These reports inspired the Oregon Education Investment Board's Equity and Partnership Subcommittee to focus attention on the GED program with their own report, which eventually led to our legislative body funding efforts to strengthen the state GED program. I am no longer the GED administrator, but I thought it would be important for everyone to learn about the new GED test and how its rigor has increased college attendance on a national level and local level. I have invited Scott Salises from GED Testing Service to provide this overview. I have also invited Donna Llewellyn from the Higher Education Coordinating Commission to provide an overview of our state GED program and data on persistence rates related to our GED graduates. And if you all have questions, certainly ask Scott or Donna when they finish their presentation.
Thank you very much, Chair Alonzo Leon, Chair Reardon. Thank you very much. We're thrilled to be here today. I appreciate the opportunity to talk about the GED testing program.
And Scott, I need to have you actually say your name for the
sure,
record.
Thank you. So I am Scott Salises. I am a state relationship manager with GED Testing Service. I actually live in Boston, Massachusetts, but I've been working with the state of Oregon over the last several years in terms of all things GED testing program related to the state of Oregon.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank
Appreciate
you.
Your being here today.
Happy to be here, yes. So for my piece today, I'm going to cover a brief history of the test, talk a little bit about the review, the why behind a new GED test. I'm going to talk a little bit about some Oregon-specific GED testing data and give you a little context and comparison to national GED testing data. Talk briefly about something that's called the American Council on Education credit recommendations for those who are scoring at the higher levels of the GED test. And talk briefly about our partnership with some large employers, something we call GED Works. So a brief history of the GED test, just to kind of frame this. So the test was developed by an organization called the American Council on Education. It came into existence in 1942. The reason for the test being developed, of course, related to World War II, where you had a lot of soldiers coming home who did not have a high school credential and kind of aged out of high school, needed a way to obtain a high school credential. So that's how the test came to be. It was originally strictly for members of the military for its early part of its existence. Late 1940s and into the 1950s, actually civilians began to take the GED test in a number of states, starting in New York State. And this grew over time. In 1963, we became, as we're known now, as GED Testing Service. And finally, your neighbors to the South, California, they became the final state to actually start utilizing the GED test in the early 70s. And since then, of course, it's been used nationwide as a second chance for those who did not earn their high school diploma. A brief history in terms of the test series. So the initial test series, initial test was in place for quite a while, about 35 years there. Since then, from the second test series on, every 10 to 15 years, we have introduced a new test, you know, to keep up with changes in K-12. Of course, it is high school equivalency, so it's reflective of what is being taught in the K-12 environment. We had our fifth test series debut in January 1st of 2014, and that's largely what we'll be talking about here today, and that test series is currently in place. We have had 18 million test passers since inception in 1942. Huge alumni. I would challenge any college to match our alumni in terms of the amount of people who have passed the test over the years. Notable grads include a U.S. Surgeon General, state governors, members of Congress, state legislators, business leaders, and maybe most importantly, millions of people, our neighbors, coworkers, family members. Since I've been in this job, I can't tell you how many times in a conversation with somebody, I've talked to somebody, and they've said, "What do you do?" And I've told them what I do, and they've said, "Oh, I took the GED test, I earned my GED, or my brother did, or sister did," if I had a dollar for every time I've talked with somebody. So in terms of the why behind a new test, so the new test and supporting testing program debuted in January of 2014, and it really was the biggest change that we've made really in the history of the GED test dating back to 1942. What we saw was that the last test had been developed in the late 1990s and been in place from 2002 to 2013. And what we saw in the world of education in K-12 was a lot of changes that were developing throughout K-12 and in education. You had No Child Left Behind. You had certainly technology in the classroom. You had various states introducing their state standards over the years. And really what we were looking at was, our GED test takers were not set up enough for success. We had colleges and businesses coming to us saying, the test has been an excellent second chance for people throughout its history, but it's not adequately preparing people to come into our institutions to just be successful in post-secondary or to fill those open jobs that we had. At the same time, we were looking at our own testing population and seeing that far too many of them wanted to go on to post-secondary. about two-thirds of them wanted to, but only about one of the only about one person out of the two-thirds who wanted to go on to post-secondary was actually coming out with any type of meaningful credential. Too many of them were ending, after passing the GED test, were ending up in developmental ed classes and simply not being prepared to enter, be in post-secondary or to obtain good paying jobs. So we really felt that the test needed to be overhauled, not minor tweaks, that it really needed significant changes. So as I was saying, there, you know, there's fewer and fewer low-skill jobs available, and there's fewer jobs that are available in defining low-skill as something that would be a high school education or less. Most of the, more and more of the jobs, they require something beyond the high school credential. Grads simply were not set up for success, I said, in the world of post-secondary ed. So we really felt like we needed to make significant changes to it. So a few facts, you know, approximately 60% of community college students require remediation. I mean, that varies by, can vary by state, but it's a large amount of people. The majority of people are coming in and needing remediation. About 75% of jobs that will require more than just a high school credential by the year 2024. I mean, we're not that far off from that number now at this point. Many middle-skill jobs, a middle-skill job being something that requires more than a high school credential but less than a four-year degree, go unfilled. Many, many middle-skill jobs that are available to people, they cannot find enough qualified applicants.
Can I interrupt just for a minute?
Yes.
So approximately 60% of community college students require remediation. Do you have a breakdown as to GET versus high school diploma and how they compare in their need for additional help?
Yeah, I don't off the top of my head, but I know probably historically in the past with the old test series, I think the amount of people GED test takers needing remediation was higher than the high school graduates. With the new GED test, with a more rigorous test, we're seeing changes there. We've seen some early signs that GED test takers may actually be needing less remediation than high school graduates, but it's probably around the same level. Certainly with the new testing program.
Same as it used to be, or that they are par now?
On par. It used to be that the GED test takers we're seeing were actually probably at a higher level than 60%.
Okay.
Yeah. Now we're seeing on par or maybe even slightly better than high school students
okay.
in terms of needing Great. Remediation. A little Oregon-specific data. By 2024, about 76% of job openings in Oregon will require more than a high school credential. About 46% of the jobs available will be these middle-skill jobs, jobs that require less than a four-year diploma, but something more than just a high school credential. And you have a very ambitious goal with your 40-40-20, and certainly getting folks who currently don't have a high school credential is key in trying to meet this goal. So what we developed when we were changing this was this is the model we use: prepare, perform, progress. And I'm not going to go through all of those bullets, but really what we set out to develop was a testing program that provided many more resources for test takers prior to testing, helping them to prepare, also helping the instructors in adult education who are helping test takers to prepare, with the test itself to have a more rigorous test that was aligned with current standards, also to give test takers more feedback on their strengths and weaknesses, a key thing that was lacking with the old test, and to help them, to get them thinking about next steps in terms of college and career, to give them tools available to help them as they're going on to those next steps. So it wanted to have much more than in the past where we had really just a test. This was a full testing program from beginning to end. A quick overview of the test for you I think would be helpful. So the GED testing is aligned to the college and career readiness standards for adult education. The test measures both high school equivalency and also career and college readiness. What it's measuring is higher order thinking skills and reasoning skills that are needed for success in jobs and college and career training programs. It's really measuring those critical thinking skills, problem solving skills that people are going to need. Less of a focus just simply on the old test with more on reading comprehension, a little more on memorization. Now it's much more on those skills that people can develop around critical thinking and problem solving. Skills you're going to use beyond taking the GED test, whether it's post-secondary or it's career. Ensures that passers demonstrate the knowledge and skills on par with high school grads. The test was standardized and normed on a national sample of high school grads in the summer of 2013, and that is used to determine what the cut point will be on the test based on a national sample of high school grads from across the country. As I said, some of the key skills here that we're trying to develop with people here is critical thinking skills, problem-solving skills, close reading skills, and in the case of the evidence-based writing, where there is writing, having them demonstrate, utilize evidence, things they're all going to use, whether it's in post-secondary or if it's any type of job, they're going to utilize these skills. Purposes of the GED test, of course, first and foremost, has always been to award a high school credential. With the new test, we've also have this higher level career and college readiness skills as well, and I'll get into a little bit more on that in a few slides. And I'll talk about the higher levels that we've set as well for demonstrating career and college readiness and what that can mean for somebody who achieves those levels. Also, one of the key things was to provide a candidate with their strengths and weaknesses, to say these are the strengths you've demonstrated on the test, and here are some of the weaknesses that you could improve as well. So giving people actionable feedback. The test has four subject areas to it: mathematical reasoning, reasoning through language arts, which comprises reading and writing, science, and social studies. Total testing time there, if you add it up, is a little over 7 hours of testing time. Test has a number of different items, has multiple choice, of course, but it also has other type of questions here, fill in the blank, drag and drop, other type of questions that challenge people cognitively more than just a multiple choice question. There are short answer responses on science, and reasoning through language arts has what we call an extended response, which is a writing piece where they're going to have to write approximately 300 to 500 words in order to adequately answer the prompt. The score range is 100 to 200, 200 being a perfect score. Test takers must earn a minimum score of 145 on each subject area to pass. We originally had set the passing score at 150. A little over a year ago, after research, talking with state partners, Oregon was a key partner in that. We decided that it was appropriate, after a couple years, to change the passing score to 145. We didn't change the test itself. We simply changed the passing score that was required. Not unusual for a standardized test after a new test comes out after a couple of years to refine things. So that change was made. We feel it was the right thing to do, and I think our state partners agree with us on that.
Scott, can you mention a little bit about how Oregon impacted those changes?
Sure. So the changes, Oregon was a key piece in this. Oregon had done some research a couple of years back that actually showed that the GED test takers who were passing the new GED test and who were enrolling in post-secondary education were actually needing remediation or developmental ed classes at a lower rate than high school students. So that was a key piece for us and something we hadn't seen from other states. And what that told us was that the GED test is designed to be high school equivalency. We don't want to ask more of people who are taking the GED test than we do of somebody who's graduating high school, but we also don't want to ask less of them. So we took a look at that, and it was a key piece of evidence for us to say maybe we think this score does need to be moved, the passing score, from 150 to 145. So it was a really critical piece of evidence to us and research that other states had not provided and Oregon had. That was a key piece for us. And I know Donna, I think, is going to, Donna's going to touch on this briefly as well here. Okay.
So the three performance levels I mentioned, high school equivalency at 145 to 164. Once you get to 165, we consider that, we call it GED college ready. And once you get to the highest level, 175 or above, we call it GED college ready plus credit. And for each of those two higher levels, the GED college ready and the college ready plus credit, there's actually an associated credit recommendation that's been made to colleges regarding people who are scoring at those levels. And I'm actually going to get to those slides in just a minute to show you what actually the benefit is for students who are scoring at those levels. T- test is delivered via computer. Test takers have to go into a proctored environment, into a center, which is often at a community college or other organization, take the test. Of course, as I said, it's a proctored environment. A paper-based test is available as an accommodation. Test takers receive their scores within 2 to 3 hours of testing. In the old GED test, just to give you a little context here, it varied by states, and Oregon was pretty good in getting scores back to people. But we had some states across the nation where it would take weeks for people to get scores. I mean 2, 3, 4 weeks to get scores. People were waiting. They needed to have jobs hanging on this or enrollment in college. So moving to 2 to 3 hours is really it's a huge change and a benefit for test takers.
You want questions as we go? A little late to ask this, but or
that's fine. Yes, questions. Questions are fine.
Perhaps someone might have one.
Thank you, Chair. So I was curious. I see a lot in your slides. You're talking a lot about college readiness. I'm wondering, is that new terminology that you've been placing with the GED test, in the process, or how do we consider, or are we considering the trades, apprenticeships? So seems to be an emphasis on college ready, but what about those that are, going off to a, and someone's going to be looking at their transcripts in that way? Or even the military. I mean, the military looks at where they're going to possibly place somebody within a certain program. And so I was just curious about that.
Sure. So college ready can be a catch-all for a lot of things, where it can mean it's going to be anywhere from a certificate program or maybe a trade as well, all the way up to, of course, a bachelor's degree. But we certainly, we have about two-thirds of our test takers who say they want to move on to some form of post-secondary. And again, that could mean anything from a certificate program. So I think, we're using that terminology, but we're really, trying to prepare people so they are prepared for whether it is a trade or whether it is post-secondary, whether it is a certificate program, a welding program, things like that.
Oh, that was my cue to say follow-up when you were done. Sorry.
Sure.
Follow-up? Sure. Thank you, Chair. I'm curious then, because why, maybe then, why wouldn't you use the terminology of post-secondary? I'm just curious. Sometimes they have such an emphasis on college, and there are so many other opportunities. My husband is a GED completer, a success story, and he went on to the military, and they kind of looked at, where he was to be able to place, in the program. So
we often use the term I guess we use most commonly is college and career. I mean, we do talk a lot about career and college. So I guess we use them both heavily. Post-secondary. I don't know what the word choice was made. I guess maybe college just maybe relates. People think more college than, I guess, post-secondary. But we certainly focus on college and career. And we're really talking both things. And oftentimes, sometimes college can be needed before the career. But we're really talking about both. So really an emphasis. There is an emphasis on both, certainly.
Okay, great. Any other questions while we're paused here? Please, Rev. Bynum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I am super curious as to how we get kids that are like 13 graduating from Princeton. Do they do it through the GED? How they do it?
They're the minimum age for GED testing is 16 years of age.
Okay, so maybe not. I'm just trying to figure out how they're matriculating, and because I know Representative Hayden, I think, did his GED, and it's like a super whiz kid and went straight through to his undergraduate institution. I'm not sure he graduated. So I was just curious.
I've always questioned if he graduated, too.
Yeah.
How many people taking the test actually, what percentage actually pass it or maybe have to do retakes? Or
I actually have that coming up. I think it's okay. Yes, excellent. Thank you. Good segue. So these are Oregon-specific numbers there in green from 2014 through current day.
on tape.
So we've seen about 20,000 test takers. So that's anyone who has started the testing process all the way up to people who have passed the full test. A completer, just to define this briefly for you, a completer is somebody we define as somebody who has taken all four parts of the GED test, but they haven't necessarily passed all four parts of the test. A passer, of course, is somebody who has passed all four parts of the test. So over the last 3 and almost a half years, there have been 12,814 passers in the state of Oregon. Nationally, we're just below 400,000. Your pass rate there is 91%, which is 8 points higher than the national average over that same time period. And in my last bullet there, I wanted to call this out. You're actually tied with two other states for the 8th highest pass rate in the country in terms of GED testing pass rate. So you're clearly doing good work here.
One other question. So we have X number of students that do not graduate each year, some percentage. And those would be people, I would assume, are eligible to take the GED. Do we know how many of the high school dropouts, what percentage take GED over time?
Yeah, regrettably, Chair Reardon, it's fairly low in terms of a percentage of the total people who certainly don't have a high school credential in the state of Oregon, those who are actually engaged in trying to obtain one. It's a pretty low percentage, meaning like if we took all of the folks in the state of Oregon who do not have a high school credential right now, taking all ages, not separating out by ages. Of course, some of those folks would be at an age where they would be retired and it wouldn't matter professionally for them. But it's a fairly low percentage, meaning about 2 to 3% are actually engaged in obtaining their passing the GED test.
If I can add to that comment, Chair Reardon, this is why it's so imperative that the $2 million that we got into 2015, that money is imperative in helping really strengthen the Oregon GED program. And Donna will talk certainly more around the development, like the evolution of our GED program in Oregon, and how the new efforts will help increase folks who don't have a high school diploma, increase those numbers and having them earn their GED.
Like a real opportunity for us.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Rep. Solman.
Thank you, Chair. I just have a couple of questions. So one is when someone goes through a GED process and taking the test, are they considered a high school dropout then according to that school district? I'm curious because they didn't get a diploma through the school district, and how does that work? And then on the other side of that, we have, like in Hillsborough, we have care coordinators or graduation coaches. So is this part of the discussion with those students that are at risk and saying, here's some options for you? Is that something that's part of it?
And I can answer to that question, Donna, if you have also a response. So in the state of Oregon, we have what we call the options program in partnership with the Oregon Department of Education. So there's been a misconception that the GED program is within the Oregon Department of Education. It's not. It's under the Higher Education Coordinating Commission in the Office of Community Colleges and Workforce Development. And so we do partner with ODE. And so there's a population of students who are in the high schools, who are working on their GED in the high school. So they get to, in some high schools, they walk alongside their peers who earn their high school diploma. But there's also option programs outside of the high schools that allow 16 to 21-year-olds, because you can be you're still considered a high school student, and this is kind of until you're age 21, outside of the school district as well. And Bob Salazar, who was here, he looks like he stepped out. He would have been a great person because he oversees that program through ODE. He would be able to give you a more comprehensive understanding. But essentially, we do have students in the high schools prepping for the GED.
And this is our first introduction today, so we may need to call these folks back someday and have additional details. But this is my first hearing on GED, and I've been involved with education this is my third term, so really exciting to learn about this.
Just a little more on data. Good news here. So Oregon, this is the pass rate by subject area. And I put the national numbers in parentheses there to give you a little context, just to show you again that Oregon is exceeding the national averages there. Very impressive. I thought you might be interested in this. This is the percentage of test takers on the GED test who are getting to those higher levels that I mentioned, that we call it the career and college readiness level. So for math, it's 12% in Oregon, 9% nationally. RLA, it's reasoning through language arts, sorry for the acronym. It's 21%. It's only 14% nationally. So you're significantly higher than the national averages, as well as in science and social studies as well. So in addition to the overall pass rate of the GED test and the important numbers here on the career and college readiness levels, you're also significantly higher than national averages. Briefly on these credit recommendations I mentioned. So the American Council on Education has a credit recommendation service, and what they do is they have been doing credit recommendations for going back all the way to 1945. They have about 700 organizations they work with, and they review about 33,000 courses and exams. Some of them I'll mention here, some of them you may have heard of, is the College Board Advanced Placement Tests, the College Board College Level Examination Program, National Career Readiness Certificate, Microsoft Certification Exams. So what the American Council on Education Credit Recommendation does is they review these exams, and then they make recommendations to colleges based on their review to say, for people who are scoring at the higher levels of these exams and entering your institutions, the test takers or the persons who are enrolling should receive some type of benefit based on the fact that they are scoring at pretty high levels. So the American Council on Education did a two-phase review of the GED test in 2014 and 15. They have a group of faculty from 2- and 4-year institutions do this review. And it resulted in recommendations that are reflected in those two upper performance levels. So the two recommendations are these. The first one we call GED College Ready, and that's for anyone who's scoring 165 or higher in a particular subject. The recommendation to colleges is that students who are scoring at that level would bypass placement exams and go directly into credit-bearing college classes. The second recommendation, this one is a little bit of a newer recommendation to colleges, is that people who are scoring at that highest level of 175 or higher would actually be eligible to be awarded college credits. So credit for prior learning. The analogy I used here often is maybe somebody in high school taking an advanced placement class and earning college credit with it. These folks who are scoring at this highest level. So these two recommendations have been put out there to colleges, and we've seen a decent amount of colleges starting to review and adopt these recommendations. So I highlighted the Oregon colleges at the top. These are the ones who I know have adopted. They've adopted this first recommendation that I talked about, where somebody who's scoring at 165 or higher comes into their institution, that they would actually bypass placement testing and go directly into college credit-bearing college classes. There could be others in Oregon as well that I'm not aware of, but I know these four have adopted that recommendation, and I know many others, including Portland Community College, Chemeca Community College, are looking at these recommendations, and I think at some point in the not-so-distant future they will adopt them as well. I just listed some other college systems there across the country. It's not an exhaustive list of all the colleges, but just wanted to note there that some of community college systems as a whole have decided to adopt these recommendations, as well as at least one 4-year institution that I've listed there as well. So this is it's an important thing, and it certainly can be a benefit to our GED test takers who are scoring at the higher levels. Can be another thing to help them enroll in college and make that transition easier for them. And certainly those who are scoring at the highest level could potentially be awarded college credit.
Scott, if I can add to that, that would mean that some of our students who get to bypass the placement test in each of the subject items get to save money because they don't have to take all these courses to get to that college class. So that's, you know, we talk about making college more affordable for our students. this is definitely a way to help students be successful.
Absolutely. Just briefly on some research, we've done some tracking of our GED grads over the last few years in terms of tracking them in enrollment in post-secondary education. We've seen that about 35% of our GED grads have enrolled within post-secondary within 1 year. To give you a little context, we looked at this, we did a similar study about a decade ago, and the number was about 24% were enrolling in post-secondary within a year of passing the GED test. So it has increased from the percentage from about 24% to 35%. Within 2 years, we're seeing about 41% of our GE grads that we looked at go on to enroll in post-secondary. And the third bullet there, I think, might be the most encouraging one that we've seen. I talked at the beginning saying that with the old GED test, too many of our test takers were not adequately prepared to be successful in colleges and were ending up in those developmental ed classes. Thus far, we've seen that Of the GED grads who have enrolled in college, 93%, when we went back and looked 2 years later, were still enrolled. And what that says to us is that they appear to be prepared to be there, that they're not ending up in dev ed classes and washing out after a semester or maybe a year, that they actually are prepared to be there if they're still enrolled 2 years, 2 years later. So that's encouraging for us. I'd also mention that we're trying to work with individual states to get more data like this. Oftentimes, states have the best access to state-level data better than we would have at a national level. And Oregon's been a terrific partner with that, starting with Representative Alonzo Leon and now Donna in terms of working with them to try to partner on data and get more information about enrollment in post-secondary and possibly job-related information as well on GED test takers and what people are doing beyond just passing the test. Briefly on GED Works, I just want to mention this to you, it's something you're aware of. We had a few years ago some big national employers come to us and say, we have employees who do not have a high school credential. We know that if they could gain a high school credential, it would benefit them. It would benefit us as the employer in terms of retention and promoting from within. I said, how can you help us? So we work with them to create a program that we call GED Works. And what it is the employers offers a benefit to their employees, and in one case, family members of their employees. They will pay for GED testing. They will pay for a practice test, which will tell the individual whether they're likely to pass the GED test. They will also, it also includes preparation material, you know, study material for people to prepare for the test. And we have folks on our staff who we call student advisors who help these employees who enroll to help them along, answer questions, and try to keep them engaged. So the companies will pay for this. And here are the companies who we currently have as our partners in this GED Works. Walmart, Taco Bell, Kentucky Fried Chicken. We recently added Pizza Hut. The last one there, the Southeastern Grocers, is a company, is a supermarket chain in the Southeast, so that wouldn't be applicable up here. We're also having some conversations with some other large national employers about this. But this is the first time we've partnered with some large employers like this to try to help their employees. The companies will pay for everything related to GED testing to help their employees. And Walmart is the company I mentioned who will not only pay for any of their employees who do not have a high school credential, they will also pay for family members of any of their employees who do not have a high school credential. And I think you're probably all aware that Walmart in any state is a pretty large employer, and they have a fair amount of people who do not have a high school credential working there. So that is my piece. Certainly, I'm here for additional questions, and I'll hand it over to Donna here.
Donna, thank you for being here. We are running kind of short on time. Scott was really thorough, and we appreciate that. It's really super interesting, but we'd love to hear what you have to say.
Sure. Chair Ridden, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Donna Lewelling. I am the Deputy Director of the Office of Community Colleges and Workforce Development. I'm currently serving as the interim GED Administrator for the state of Oregon. I do want to be mindful of the committee's time, so I'll go through some of my slides maybe a little faster than I might have otherwise, but part of that's because Scott did a good job of covering some of the stuff, so that's true partnership. So my first slide, Scott talked about in his presentation a little bit about the national timeline. This is a very brief overview of the history of the GED here in Oregon. We started testing in 1946 with military veterans. You can see that we moved on to testing civilians in 1952. 2014 was a big year. Not only did we get the new GED test series, but we also held our first Oregon GED summit. I'll talk a little bit more about what that is in my coming presentation. And then in 2015, Oregon did make that appropriation of $2 million that Representative Alonzo Leon referred to earlier in her testimony, and I'll provide some information related to that. Next slide, please. The 2014 change in the test series actually led to changes in Oregon as well. It provided us an opportunity for us to review and make changes in the Oregon's program. Previously, Oregon's program was focused on security and compliance, so we approved new test sites, we dealt with noncompliance, we trained new chief administrators, we coordinated the testing or the test readers for writing tests and state and regional meetings for chief administrators. As Vice Chair Alonzo Leon mentioned in her opening remarks, catalysts in helping develop the new focus for the program itself include not only the 2014 GED test change, but also the February 2013 Secretary of State audit report, as well as the 2014 public Portland City Club report related to the Oregon GED program. Those changes were implemented through working closely with GED testing services regarding the transfer of records and working with GEDTS to take a more hands-on approach for providing services to students regarding their records and test prep. And all of that came together to provide us an opportunity to reframe our infrastructure, expand partnerships, create new policies and procedures, and offer professional development opportunities through our GED test or our GED summit. The next slide just provides quite a bit of an overview of some of the development in Oregon's GED program over the past 3 years. I won't go into detail on this slide, but we'll just call out that we are seeing an increase in testing sites. I've actually approved 3 new test sites in the last couple months alone. Our prep and instruction sites are in places such as community colleges and community partners, and those are places that reach out to diverse populations, which you know is very important.
Could you, let me interrupt you just for a minute. I think this is really probably a key part of your presentation, I would guess. How many, you need additional funding to carry this program forward, correct?
We need continued funding.
Funding.
Yes, Chair.
Do you have numbers in here on how many people will be served, how successful this has been in terms of?
I do have preliminary information. I don't have exact numbers yet because this is the first year of the investment, but I will be speaking about it. Yes, Chair.
I've been very impressed by what I'm hearing so far. Also, being mindful of time, I want to make sure you get a chance to make your pitch.
Absolutely. I promise to make it and make it quickly.
Okay.
The 2015-17 legislative funding does help support the GED annual summit, which is a statewide professional development opportunity. We are in the middle of completing our bilingual outreach and communications campaign, the development of the materials. I'm excited we should be having those out in the next couple of weeks. Grants to local programs for wraparound services. I'll talk more in detail about those in a couple of minutes, as well as 2 new staff to support local programs and students. We've also, as I mentioned, with some of this increased investment, allowed us to increase partnership with GED testing services and be more intentional with that. In terms of some GED test quick facts for Oregon, the tests are relatively inexpensive. They're $38 per module for the GED test. That equates to $152 for all 4 modules. Retakes are discounted, so $10 per test for the second and third attempt. Practice tests are available at low or no cost, which is important in helping prepare. And Oregon offers the test in both English and in Spanish. Candidates for the GED, as have been kind of mentioned before, need to be over the age of 16. Some students prepare independently. Some students prepare by taking classes at their local community college or their community-based program. And most underage youth prepare by participating in their local GED options program. Here in Oregon, we have policies that support our students. We actually have the McKinney-Vento Act, which is a homeless youth policy, and students enrolled in state school district without government issued ID. For those students, they must bring not only their school ID, but a letter from the school district on district letterhead that's signed by the administrator and also includes those pieces of information on the letter as indicated in the slide. The Oregon GED program, along with the Oregon Department of Education and GEDTS, are working together to develop an umbrella policy for candidates who are not actively enrolled in a school district, so ages 16 to 21, who do not have a government-issued ID and who would like to take the GED test. We anticipate that the finalization of that particular policy will take place in the next couple of months prior to the new school year, and it will follow the same sorts of requirements as this homeless youth policy that's indicated on this slide. And Scott talked a little bit about accommodations, but some accommodations that are also made for GED test takers include testing in a separate room, extra testing time and extra breaks, or taking the test via written as was indicated before. Next slide. Other policies that support students, obviously, are the College Ready and College Ready Plus credit recommendations that Scott spoke about before. Also, the change in test scores, that passing score changing from 150 to 145 actually resulted in an additional 500-plus Oregon students receiving their GED. So it was significant in the lives of those Oregon students. Next slide. We have lots of systems that support the GED program. The GED manager, that's the student record warehouse. Its access is granted to it through approval by the state administrator, so those records are closely kept. GED analytics is the data system that GED testing services has, and I'll share some great data that comes out of that system here in a minute so you can get a snapshot. As well as GED credentialing, that's a student access portal. Basically, it has bilingual support, and that's where students can also access their certificates and transcripts. Next slide. So of the students who have taken the new GED test since January 1, 2014, 65% of them indicated they were unemployed. 72% reported an annual income of $5,000 or less. 40% reported that a family member influenced them to obtain their GED. 57% of them were male, and the average age of our GED test takers was 24. Those are just some of the types of data points that we can get out of GED analytics. Next slide. Some test taker demographics. You can see we have a pretty diverse student population. We do have 20% that are Hispanic or Latino. And this same kind of information comes out of the GED analytics system. So we can take a look at where our student populations are as well as their demographic information so that we can tailor our program and support services to help better serve those students and those who actually work with them. Next page. This slide is a slide that talks about the story of student progression to Oregon's community colleges. The slide shows for students, and the slide is around a July 1 to June 30 annual kind of academic year snapshot. You will see a drop in the 2014-15 numbers. This is likely due to the change in the test. But it's important to note that while the numbers overall decreased, we see an increase in the percentage of those progressing on to post-secondary education in Oregon's colleges. I believe that's an indicator that the test change is making a difference in making sure our students are college and career ready. While the numbers aren't in yet for progression, I can tell you the cohort size for 2015-16 has increased by approximately 56%. With our increased focus on professional development and student wraparound services, I anticipate a continued increase in the percentages of progression to post-secondary education. Next slide. This next slide is about My Path, Our Future High School Scholars of Oregon. This is a scholarship that we have in Oregon that supports the GED pathway and honors the work of earning a GED. As you can imagine, sitting for that many hours of testing is a lot. Students must have completed their GED. FAFSA is recommended but not required. It's open to all GED graduates and students who enroll in post-secondary education at least half-time. Last year, we were able to award one $500 scholarship. This year, we anticipate being able to award a larger amount. Here's a quick overview of our Oregon GED Annual Summit. Our yearly educational summit brings attendees to together to participate in interactive workshops, attend a plenary session featuring GED student success stories, and also provides a forum for state leaders to share their vision for the Oregon GED program while providing an opportunity to visit national vendors, showing the latest in GED tools for success and participating in network opportunities. Last year, we saw over 300 educators, community partners, administrators, testing sites, and others come together for the purpose of collaborating towards a brighter future for GED candidates. This year, we're looking forward to a stronger partnership with adult basic skills providers.
Donna, if we're gonna, I need to have you come to a good closing point so we can get a couple of questions. Okay.
Yep, two slides away. Next slide. This next one is around the GED wraparound grant. So $1.6 million awarded, 16 programs funded, an average award of about $98,000. You can see where the grantee types are there. Actually, we're serving quite a bit of rural parts of Oregon. And the services, I have a list of the wraparound services being done, but there's everything from bus passes and gas cards to helping with testing fees and childcare, all those barriers that keep folks from being able to take the test. So the additional investments also supported the outreach campaign that's bilingual, social media, radio, and TV, information programs. We are actually getting a new program logo that will actually help us be able to be identified. And then also I indicated we hired additional staff and additional administrative support, as well as the administrator position at full time. And that actually concludes my presentation.
Good job. We have a couple other questions.
Sure, absolutely.
Do you work with the school, like high school career advisors, to talk about GED? So that's one of their options that they can talk to kids about? Or
Chair Reardon, yes. Through our GED Options Partnership, as well as some of our other partnerships, we actually are intentionally trying to make sure that information is getting out as this being a viable option for students who a high school diploma is not.
Okay. Rep. Swollman.
Thank you, Chair. I was just curious, you had mentioned in your outreach campaign about bilingual outreach opportunities. Do you offer the test in multiple languages?
Yes, Representative Solomon, Chair Reardon, we do. We offer it in both English and Spanish at this time.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? Yeah, Rep. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You had a couple slides talking about data. And I think you said that the folks had their own system that they're reporting to you, but is this incorporated into the longitudinal data system we're working on that the HEX administering so we can track these students effectively as they go through the system?
Chair Reardon, Representative Johnson, yes. So, for instance, the slide where I spoke about the Oregon GED student progression, that was done in consultation by being able to pull out the information from the GED analytics system and actually marry it with the HEX information.
Well, thank you both. This has been very thought-provoking, very stimulating, informative, all those good things. I think it'll serve us well in a lot of future conversations, and I really appreciate both of you being here today.
So. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
All right. I'm closing the informational hearing and opening an informational hearing on our National Student Success Network. And we have Elizabeth Cox with us today from the Oregon Student Success Center and Greg Holman from Lynn Benton Community College. And thank you for your patience. I hope you enjoyed the presentation that we had.
We know a lot about it.
That's weird to know.
I know.
Wow.
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 I'm not going to take that.
Yeah,
it's a good thing they're going to watch this on tape.
Wow.
Sure do, I guess.
I was just trying to say, I've got good news. We've got about 15 slides, and I'm not asking for money.
Look at that.
So, ding, ding, ding.
And you got a new logo, too.
And I got a new logo.
Look at that.
That was designed by students, by the way.
Really?
Yes. Great. It was designed by, it was a student project, and they researched Oregon and the trees and all the beauty.
Before we pat you on the back too much, be sure to introduce yourself.
Oh, yes. So, for the record, my name is Elizabeth Cox Brandon, the executive director for the Oregon Student Success Center. The students that designed this, then they decided the tree is all about learning, it's about Oregon, it's organic, and all of that. And then the little star in the center is supposed to be the Success Center to help navigate all of these different pieces. So, yeah, she's pretty proud of that.
Nice brand.
Yeah, yeah, not bad. And it was free, and students got work experience. So it was a win all the way around, all the way around. So thank you for having us here today. I wanted to talk with you a little bit about the National Student Success Center Network, as you mentioned. The National Network's been around for about 5 years. It actually started in two states, which was Arkansas and Michigan. And it was originally funded by the Kresge Foundation. Since that time, many partners have become engaged in the network, and that includes Lumina, Achieving the Dream, the Community College Research Center, this Community College Survey of Student Engagement, the National Center for Inquiry and Improvement. Many big partners are involved in this network, so it's a pretty impressive group to be part of, and we're happy to be a member. So there's 14 states currently. Oregon was number 13. We were the newbie until Wisconsin just joined last month, so we're no longer the new kid on the block. But in this network, we serve over half of the community college students in the nation, including two-thirds of the students of color and many of the low-income students that are in our community colleges. So we have a wide-ranging grasp on what is happening with our students, and we have a lot of information and resource that we can share with each other through our participation in the network. It really is interesting to be able to learn from some of these centers that have been doing this work, like Michigan, for the last 6 years. Michigan's a lot like Oregon. It's decentralized in their community college system. The little difference is they don't have any kind of higher education coordinating commission, so their community college association is very active. But we have a lot of things in common, so it's really helpful to learn from them. This just gives you an overview of where we are. We're kind of bookending the nation, and then with Texas and Arkansas in the middle. And so Wisconsin just got added. They haven't even updated the slides yet. So why did they decide to come into student success centers? Well, the big idea is that we've had a lot of these individual initiatives that have been happening all around the edges. And unless we're actually going to bring things to scale and impact every student, it's not really going to make a difference. So the community college, the success centers are there to help create coherency across the colleges and to help them actually make a framework that will be statewide that can help scale these types of initiatives that will help our students be successful. We also are here to help our colleges learn from each other. You're going to hear from President Heyman here in a minute. Lynn Benton is part of a National American Association of Community Colleges. Did I steal your thunder?
It looked like you did.
I know. So they're part of a national cohort. I won't say anymore. But we can obviously learn a lot from Lynn Benton, and they stand at the ready to help us with the rest of our colleges to be going into this guided pathways work. So again, this is who we serve through the network, through 14 different states. A majority of the community college students, including 56% of Pell Grant recipients in community colleges. So it is a very wide-reaching network. This is a little bit about what we do. The key takeaways here are
the top two, in my opinion, providing coherence. For example, again, this is taking all of the different pieces from Oregon as an example. I'm working with a national public relations firm to create an infographic because we have done so many different things in Oregon, and bringing that together to show how it actually will fit into a framework for moving all of us forward and to help our students be successful. Because we've got a lot. We've done a lot, but we need to do it to scale is the key. So as you can see with the sub-bullet there, it's one of our key initiatives, one of our key frameworks for action is guided pathways. And Greg will be talking more about that in a minute. Another key function of our center is to convene. One of the things that gets cut immediately, it seems, out of our budgets when we have tough times is the money to be able to convene or professional development. So the center then can have resources to pull people together. We've only been around for about 10 months, but we've already been able to pull together faculty professional development on working with students that are in trauma. We're creating a guide for post-secondary for working with students in trauma. We have been doing growth mindset work with faculty to help them with all of our students. So we've been doing some of these things that are a little bit smaller, but again, they all feed into the larger picture. So again, just on our personal end, Oregon actually had applied twice to the national network. They have an RFP that goes out every couple of years. And so we applied and didn't make it. But through persistence, anybody who knows me knows I don't take no for an answer. Through persistence and great partnerships, we are one of the few centers in the nation that is locally funded. And we're very proud of that. The Ford Family Foundation and the Oregon Community Foundation have stepped up, and they've given us a three-year grant to be working on this. And I really applaud them for both of them. It's their first step into this kind of funding, so we're really excited about it, and they're fabulous partners. But again, the center is focused on being a hub for all the different things that need to happen to help our students be successful and helping our colleges, especially our smaller rural colleges that don't have research units, don't have a lot of professional development, help them so that they too can come up to speed so that none of our colleges get left behind. It's something that we like to be able to offer. For instance, the guided pathways work. There was another RFP that came out this year, and you could apply to be part of a national cohort, but it cost you a lot of money. It was $50,000.
The fee was $45,000.
Yeah, $45,000 just to play 1 year. So this is a way for us to be able to offer those types of experiences for the colleges for no cost.
Could you do me a favor?
Mm-hmm.
I might be just getting tired or something, but could you parse that second, that paragraph that says a hub for statewide shift and focus, and tell me what are you really doing?
So from transactional, meaning if we say, oh, we're going to ease our application process for students, that's very transactional. But this is more of a transformational idea, and I'm sure Greg's got many thoughts about that, because especially the guided pathways work that we're leading to, that's really a whole institution transformational framework. So it's more about your culture and your context. It's not so much about you take a box off the shelf and you just implement it on your campus. It's all of the faculty, everyone is involved in this. So it's much more transformational than just a simple fill in the blank.
And your group will help all the community colleges work on this collectively. Is that right?
Yes. I work with all 17 of our community colleges, Chair Reardon. Yes. And again, we just started in August last year, so we're just getting off the ground.
All right.
But that's, it's quick. And actually, so I was building up to the guided pathways work because obviously, as I mentioned, Greg's college is one of the 30 in the national cohort for the American Association of Community Colleges Pathways Institute. So I've asked him to come to give you a little more information about guided pathways and what it looks like on the ground at an institution.
Definitely.
we may not want to wait until next session or something.
Right. So I'll start.
Did you introduce yourself?
I will. For the record, I'm Greg Heyman, a president of Linbitten Community
Greg,
College.
We have a question already.
Yes.
For the former presenter, however.
Oh, sorry.
Okay.
Could you go back to slide 6, please? I don't think you touched on all of those bullets there. That's one there.
Mm-hmm.
Connecting policy and practice and the data capacity.
Mm-hmm.
Can you just touch on those a little bit more?
Well, the policy and practice is really something that goes hand in hand with where the center is strategically housed. It's currently housed at the Oregon Community College Association so that we can be the advocate and we can say what our colleges need us to say without being politically driven. Yes?
I just want to interject if I can.
Please.
For example, legislation around transfer is critically important to this work.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a way in which policy and practice really connect, I think, in ways that will substantially change the experience of our students.
If I could just give a follow-up to tell you what I'm thinking about. In terms of sharing best practice, would that be a part of what you're doing too?
Yes.
Okay, let me give you a practical
Johnson.
Example then regarding our wraparound services for Oregon Promise students. Colleges had a wide-ranging menu of stuff that they did. And I think as you look at the retention numbers, some are faring better than others. Would it be in your prerogative then or to go back and talk to those colleges that perhaps didn't fare as well as others and say, look at what some of your neighbors did. Maybe that's why they're a little bit more effective. I'm just saying, would you consider that to be a part of your, you know, job description, I guess, as at the center?
Well, Chair Reardon, Representative Johnson, that's not exactly
okay.
part of it to get that far into the weeds.
Okay.
But as part of the Success Center work and the Guided Pathways work, we talk about advising, we talk about first-year experience, we talk
mm-hmm.
about all of those pieces
okay.
that are part of the onboarding and the retention of students. So yeah. all of that falls into it.
I guess without a larger CCWD, we kind of lose that ability to interject some of that, but I'll just let that lie. Secondly, data. Again, I just want to make sure that we're not creating silos of data. Is this stuff integratable with, again, we've had our Peter Trumbull was here a bit ago, and the longitudinal data, so he's not here anymore. He left and you guys
right.
got up. But this is all able to interface, I'm guessing, so the system can understand what's going on.
Chair
GED to, you know, all the other stuff we're talking about, open
Correct.
Success and so forth, right?
Yeah, actually, this is a little misleading, Representative Johnson, because it's not as if the center is collecting the data. We're utilizing the data. We have a memorandum of understanding with the HEC and CCWD to be able to utilize the data that they collect. This isn't something that we wanted to add any additional burden to the colleges. So we use their metrics and their data.
So, Chair Reardon and members of the committee, so I was asked to provide, and I didn't have any slides until Elizabeth made some for me, so I'll just tell you, I was planning on having a conversation. But what we did, what she has put together is slides that come from the cohort of 30 colleges across the country who were selected to be the early implementers of a different approach to really to post-secondary education that's organized around the student. And that's going to sound a little controversial, but I will say I think we have come to learn that the way in which we deliver education is predominantly organized around content and around delivery models, but not around the student. And Guided Pathways is about changing all of that. So I think that's the difference between a transactional and a transformational. It isn't like, historically what we've done is we've said we've left the academic side of the house pretty much untouched, and we said, well, if we just gave them more support services, if we just gave them stuff around it, because this academic side is sort of hard, but if we just support them, they'll be okay. Guided Pathway says, why does it have to be so hard and so sort of not intuitively understandable? Why don't we actually address the core of the college, which is the academic side of the institution, and actually design that around the student. And that's really what the pathway side of that model is around. The goal is to take what we have historically had at community colleges, which I have different words for it, but this calls it the cafeteria college, which is essentially we offer a bunch of things, and you walk up and down the aisles, and you pick what you want, and we assume you had a good time with it, and we hope that you succeed, and we've done our job, and we go on. The data, of course, says that students don't actually succeed in that model. The vast majority of students don't complete. The vast majority of don't go on to have the kind of career and economic life that they sought when they came to us. And part of it is because of the way in which we structured education. And so that says this is essentially what we have done historically. You can show me the next slide. And this says, well, when we change that under a guided pathways, we provide clear pathways for the students. We redesign their entry experience so that they, well, I'll give you an example of the way in which we redesigned the entry experience. We talk about with students, every single student, so what do you hope to accomplish here? What's your goal? And then we'll design a pathway to get there. So it's not... what courses do you want to take? It's like, where do you want to end up? And we use advising to help them with that discussion, not to help them register for classes, because that's simple. Once you have a clear pathway, students can register. What they don't have is a person to talk with about, who do you want to be? What do you want to do? And faculty are really eminently qualified to have that conversation if we create the context for that to happen. And so that's really what that, we redesigned that whole starting point. Every student has an intensive orientation component, which we call destination graduation, that leading there. We provide data, not just for us to track our students, but for the students to be able to track themselves so that they get better at self-informing their decisions. We're not fully implemented, but the idea is that the student, when they bring up their website, they have a corner in which they say, this is my program, this is my pathway, this is how far I am along this path, this is what I have to do next term, and this is how many terms to completion. So they know exactly at any given moment where they are. So they're self-informing. They don't need an advisor to register for the next class, but what if they have a question about or a second thought about where they want to go? That's what they need an advisor for, is to have that kind of conversation. And this model is set up to do that. So this is a great example. This is not my institution, but it could be. This is what a college catalog, community college catalog, looked like historically, and some still do. We have lots of options. Recent research on how we make decisions says if you got more than 7 choices, you don't make very good decisions. There are a whole lot more than 7 choices there. And so students, why do students declare undeclared, undecided? Not because they don't have interests, not because they don't have aspirations, but because that is just way too confusing for them. And so Guided Pathway does something what we call nesting those decisions. So you make a series of decisions from which you probably never have more than 10 options. You know, at my institution, you start with 7, and you decide in based on general content, you decide one of 7 what we call meta majors. You don't have to choose a major. You have to choose an area. None of them is gen ed. None of them is undecided. All of them have a content focus. So within that, you know, we'll maybe have 15 different group programs within a meta major, but they all start at the same place. So if at the second term you go, that isn't really what I wanted to do. I want to do this thing over here. There's a really good chance that your first term still counts. And that's the goal. So you create logical sequences organized around the student's goals. You create the capacity to move horizontally across our curriculum, and the earlier you do it, the easier it is, and you make it explicitly clear to the students so that they can navigate that the educational academic side of the institution. So these are from the City Colleges of Chicago. That is their focus areas. They have 10, which is way too many. We have 7. And partly because we don't think the idea of having a liberal arts one is a very good idea, because it feels too much like a default. I don't know what I'm going to do. And so we're really careful not to give students the capacity to not decide by default. So because we know, and we don't have this slide, but the evidence says if I can get the student to make any decision, even if it's the wrong decision, in other words, they change majors, if I can get them to make a decision in the first term, they have a much greater likelihood of succeeding. And so this is really what this model is designed around. So this just showed you. Yes.
Could you hold on just for a second? Oh, go ahead.
Oh, go ahead if you want.
Well, just wondering how you chose your seven, how much was historical precedent versus how much is driven by the needs of industry.
How we did it?
Mm-hmm.
Chair Reardon. How we are intensely focused on faculty involvement. So we did it by having faculty meet until they were tired of meeting and deciding how are we going. No, it really was. And we just finished this. So we focused on, we had every program mapped. So we had every content area described for all of our 86 programs. And then we use a database to group them, and then we put it back to faculty, and we talked about, does this make sense to us? Where doesn't it make sense? We adjusted it. So it's a data-driven model. It wasn't based on, you know, tradition. It doesn't look anything like the divisions of my institution. It looks like where we have shared content so students can move more easily to pursue their goals. They do fit, because they're common content, they do fit around industry clusters, because you have common content within those cluster areas. But at our institution, clearly faculty focused, they agreed that these were the right seven for our students. So now we have to implement it.
Okay, thank you. Rep. Johnson, still a question?
Thank you, Chair. Greg, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but hearing you talk about the meta majors just seems to, I think, underline the need for a foundational core of credits that's recognized across the board, so that as you might begin in one meta major area, but yet, this isn't quite exactly right, I'm going to move over here, still this core that you've accomplished goes with you, and it's transferable, right?
Representative Johnson, Chair Reardon, that's absolutely true, and you can put those words in my mouth. In fact, I think that cleaning up the transfer issue in the state is indivisible from pathways.
Yeah.
And
you can put his words in your mouth.
Yes, I know. Those have to go together, because a pathway isn't to complete a degree. A pathway is to pursue a goal.
Exactly.
And a goal is always related to the kind of life that you want. And so it's got to start before they get to college. It's got to extend beyond the two-year institution and even beyond the four-year institution. So that's what we're working on.
Yeah, great.
We'll skip all of that stuff. So this just talks about how we're the issue of implementing this work. And one of the things I do want to say is one of the things you had to do to be one of those 30 schools that got selected is you had to recognize your own need for change. And I think sometimes that's hard for us. We like to think if you just gave us more money, and we do need more money, by the way, everything would be fine. Actually, we need the resources to implement this kind of transformational redesign of education, because it's big work. And you mentioned 45,000 to play. We have added 9 faculty positions just in the time of starting to implement this work, because we saw critical areas in which we needed more emphasis. And that's great, but pathways helped us to understand where we needed to do that. And so that's critically important. We believe, and we're starting to see this, we'll see significantly greater student success. We'll are significant better provider of an educated workforce for we have really quite rapidly growing manufacturing sector in our area, and so we're focusing on that. And this is one of the ways in which we are creating, I think, the capacity to meet that need. Let's see if there's anything else I should be saying.
Well, I'll just jump in for a second, if you don't mind.
Go for it.
That's part of the Success Center's work now, is that we have 16 other colleges in Oregon who haven't been part of this national cohort. And we need to work with them, those that are ready and those that aren't quite ready, we need to work with them to be implementing pathways, because it is that important. So that's the focus of the Success Center. That's the focus of whatever funding we might have, is to implement this for all of our colleges.
Yeah, Rep. Johnson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. So thanks for Elizabeth. I appreciate that. So the major hurdle to be overcome to be system-wide is time or resources?
Yes, Representative Johnson.
I guess I've kind of back of the napkin played around with this with Greg before, but with additional resources, how much quicker could we be?
Well, I'm actually
up
going
and
to
running,
let
let's just say.
Greg answer what, that because
I guess,
he's been.
Let me phrase it. So, what is the build out time frame now with the pathway?
So, we're Representative Johnson, Chair Ridden. We're scheduled to be fully implemented in the fall of 2018. So, it will have taken us 3 years, which is actually, I think, fast. I think it will have about a close to $1 million annual impact on our budget. At least initially, we think over time that we'll get a return on investment, and our community will get a return on investment on that that makes it well worthwhile. So it is a resource-intense project, because it isn't just a pilot project or initiative. That does, it is a reframing, and that's why we use words like transformational. It is a reframing of how we do teaching and learning at our institution. So any additional resources would help us implement faster. We have a runout. We budget on a five-year runout. And so we see, 3 years down the road, things that we should be doing that we could do a lot quicker if we had more resources, which we think would allow us to be successful more quickly for more students. That's not a dollar amount, but it's we are already expanded our budget probably by about $1 million annually.
And Greg is fortunate, well, not fortunate, Greg's smart in that Lynn Benton has a very strong institutional research office. And this is very data-driven, as you can imagine. But we have colleges that still don't even have an institutional researcher, one person to do the reporting. And actually, Lynn Benton has partnered with some of these smaller colleges just to try to help them to get their just necessary reporting done. So that's one key area when we talk about data. That's a key area that we absolutely need more resource so that we can improve that capacity.
So as we move forward from Lynn Benton to whoever is next, are those decisions primarily being made by the president and his or her board? Or is this being driven from on top somehow? I mean, how is that going to happen? How do we get to Chemeketa? How do we get to Columbia Gorge? How do we get to, Blue Mountain? How do you envision that process playing out? I guess as your presidents get together and talk about it, what's needed to move forward?
So, Representative Johnson, Chair Reardon, and members of the committee, as you know, we do very little top-down. So it is a matter of these colleges getting together, talking amongst ourselves, I think sharing our successes. I think it's fair to say that every one of the community colleges is at some level of wanting to do this. I think it's a matter of readiness. Mm-hmm. Some are more ready. And to try and start this when you're not ready would be a disaster. So one of the things that the Student Success Center, with Elizabeth's leadership, they will be doing a readiness assessment for our community colleges, so that we'll all have a much more data-driven sense of where we are in each institution in relation to their readiness to begin implementing this work. And that's the Community College Research Center is a really data-driven organization that helps put this stuff together and is really supporting us in our effort, I think, for all of us to have a better sense of how we put this together on campus. And it won't look the same on every campus, but we'll have the same result.
And just to follow up, Chair Reardon, we are planning to do that readiness assessment in October.
Right.
So we already, Greg is on my steering committee for the Success Center, along with some of our other presidents and board members, and we're planning for what we're going to be doing for the next 3 years as far as implementation. So we intend to have the first cohort of Oregon colleges ready to go by spring of 2018, and then holding a couple of institutes a year to get them down the path. And then also with those colleges that are not quite ready, we're going to form learning cadres. So there's basically the assessment looks at different capacities that an institution may have. So clarifying paths, have you mapped your pathways? Are you on that road to doing that? Well, if you're not, then we can give you some more education about how do you do that and what does that look like and who needs to be involved and how much time does it take? So we're going to be bringing along all of the colleges, even though there may be about five that are taking the next step of implementation.
Yeah.
Thank you. Elizabeth, you kind of answered my question. I was thinking about what kind of buy-in do we have of the community colleges right now? I mean, obviously we have Lynn Benton, who's fully on board and is a success story, an example for other community colleges. What is the buy-in? Are colleges excited about this? And because you kind of mentioned the process in which they can become, a pathways institution. Mm-hmm. What kind of work has to go into that?
Representative Lonzo Leon, Chair Reardon, I guess it depends on whose side you're asking what the work is, because on the college's side, obviously, it's a lot. It's a lot of work, and that's faculty all the way to presidents, to grounds crew, everybody. Everybody is part of this work, and it's part of the idea that everyone can be an advisor to a student on campus. It doesn't just fall on a certain office. So it's a lot of work on their end, a lot of time. Faculty buyout, like Greg said, you really need to have the faculty involved in this. And the colleges that are interested in this, they are ready. So I believe, I've been told, until we do the assessment, we're feeling like there's some colleges who may be closer than they think they are. So they may actually get the results of the assessment and think, well, wow, we're actually right there. But of colleges who have indicated so far, there's about five that are going to be implementing. Now, that the buy-in is across the colleges, though. It just depends on resource and on just the timing opportunity. For example, Oregon Coast Community College has just put in a letter to be considered for candidacy for accreditation. They're our last college who hasn't yet achieved independent accreditation. That's a lot of work. And that would be something that over the next year or two they'd be working on. So they just don't have the capacity to be doing this kind of work on top of that work. But they're very interested. They're very excited. They've been doing a lot of great work with multiple measures for placement, redesigning their whole intake system. They've been doing a lot of great work. So the colleges are excited.
Okay. Anything else?
We're done.
Oh, we're done.
Well, I'm super interested in what you guys are doing. I hope you won't be shy about keeping at least me informed and the rest of the committee. I hope they are interested as well. I think that House Bill 3437 will kind of fit into what you're already doing, and when we get everybody at the same table looking at workforce, and you have higher ed coordinating committee is there, and K-12 education, everybody's all talking about what are the needs of industry, and you guys have, you're building that framework that will help deliver, what we need. Mm-hmm. And it is a different model. And I'm so glad that you're there. You're kind of ahead of the curve and leading the way. But I think as those conversations, more people hear those conversations, they might be coming to you to ask, well, hey, how do you do this? Mm-hmm. And so
I'm
glad you're there. This is really great. Any other questions? Would it be okay if we close this and call it a day?
Absolutely.
All right. Well, thanks again. I'm closing the informational hearing. And before we close, just reiterate for public record, we're carrying over Senate Bill 207A to Thursday, June 1st. Should be a short meeting and a short hearing, whatever we do here. And I'm closing this meeting of the House Higher Ed and Workforce Development Committee. All right. All right.
All right. Development Committee.